Unfortunately, when we planned the Kol Yom Rishon, we didn't intend that this should be halacha l'maaseh at all. We certainly hope that it should not be any more halacha l'maaseh than it's had to be over the past few months. But under either circumstance, I think I want to, you know, if our brothers are in a very different situation than we are, I think at least we could do is dedicate our learning this morning, besides, of course, adding to whatever learning we're doing and davening we're doing and tehillim that we do, a little bit extra for to play our part in the war, because we know that Klal Yisrael, we have to work on two fronts. We have to work on the physical front, but the physical front is only effective in as much as there's the spiritual backup that actually gives the koach to the physical efforts. So again, this is a topic, ransoming hostages, something that is a wonderful sugya to learn theoretically. Unfortunately, especially this summer, and not just this summer, now also with Gilad Shalit, it's very current, and very poignant issue. And I'll tell you what made me interested in it. This past summer, I was in Yerushalayim, and each year Mosad HaRav Kook has a kinus, a convention for Torah Shebaal Peh, and they bring big rabbonim in all areas. And the keynote speaker was Rav Avadya Yosef, and he was going to speak about Pidyon Shvuyim, about this issue of ransoming hostages. And because it was the keynote speaker, it was the first day of the three-day convention, the opening for this convention was, the opener was Bibi Netanyahu, also a little bit in the news nowadays. Bibi Netanyahu made a little presentation, 10 minutes, spoke about the importance of this kind of convention and tradition, said a little spiel about his political ideology for 30 seconds, and then they went on to introduce Rav Avadya Yosef. Rav Avadya was sitting flanked on his right and left by members of Knesset, of Shas, and other people, other dignitaries in Israel, because it's a well-known convention. And he started it in the following way. He said, in 1976, the Israeli government approached me with a shaila. Apparently, an Air France jetliner had been taken captive, had been taken to Uganda. That's the whole story that we're all familiar with. July 4th, 1976, the Entebbe, what ultimately became the Entebbe rescue. What was so poignant to me is that those who know a little bit of history know that there was only one person of our team who was killed, one commander who was killed, in fact, the leader of the commando unit, that was Yoni Netanyahu, the older brother of Bibi Netanyahu, and it was incredibly poignant. As Rav Avadya is speaking about this, and speaking about the Shaila, here Rav Avadya is sitting in the middle of the section on the dais, and about three seats to his right, Bibi Netanyahu is there listening, sort of looking with out of the corner of his eye, I'm wondering what's going through his mind. And of course, as Rav Avadya continued, he made mention that, of course, it was Bibi's brother who was the karban at that time. Unfortunately, the Shaila Pidyon Shvuyim for our history is not a new Shaila. The Shaila has been around from the time of the Churban Bayis, Churban Bayis Rishon. There were plenty of Pidyon, there was plenty of Shvuyim. The time of Rami Rottenberg, that's a famous one. Later in history, most recently with Eldad Regved, Goldvatz Hashem Yikom Domen, and we know right now with Gilad Shalit, obviously just a precursor. This is not a forum to issue any kind of psak. We'll leave the psak for these kinds of shilas, for the Gdola Yisrael, who have the breadth of shoulders to bear the weight of these very, very challenging and difficult shilas on their shoulders. But let's begin. Those of you who do have the Mar Makomos, let's start from the basics. Pidyon Shvuyim, you have to ransom hostages. Is it a good thing? Is it a bad thing? Of course it's a good thing. In fact, the Gemara says in Bava Basra, that's on source 1, that Pidyon Shvuyim is a mitzvah rabbah. There's a certain, very few select mitzvos out of all the Taryag mitzvos that are considered mitzvah rabbahs, great mitzvahs. This is one of them. There may be one or two or three more, not more than that. What does it mean that something's a mitzvah rabbah? It means perhaps that you're allowed to sell a Sefer Torah. Very few things for which you're allowed to sell a Sefer Torah. One of them happens to be if there's a hostage being that there's a ransom that you have to pay, you're permitted even to go to the great extent of selling a Sefer Torah to ransom a hostage. That Tosas points out. Very few other mitzvahs have this unique quality of being called a mitzvah rabbah. Why is it a mitzvah rabbah? Well, if you look at the next source, the Rambam lists no less than 8 different mitzvos aseh or mitzvahs lo taseh that are all involved with the opportunities that arise if a person has an opportunity to do pidyon shvuim. Eight mitzvahs, some are direct, some are a little bit, you know, more general, but eight mitzvahs aseh or lo taseh that apply to this mitzvah of pidyon shvuim, of redeeming hostages. So if that's the case, it's clear, it's a mitzvah rabbah. The Rambam lists eight different sources which could all tell me and obligate me, and obligate us as a community better, to do pidyon shvuyim. So what's the problem? Let's do it. Well, here, let's begin the sugya, source 3, with a Mishnah in Gittin. Mishnah writes, Ein podin es ha-shvuyin yoseh al-kadei demehen, that we are not permitted to ransom hostages more than their value. More than their value. We'll talk about what their value is. How do you define value of a person? But why can't you? Let's first get to the reason. Mipnei tikkun olam. The rabbis instituted a certain enactment for the communal benefit, for the social welfare. Mipnei tikkun olam for social welfare. We'll see what the social welfare is as well. That I'm not allowed to ransom a hostage more than he's worth. Now, let's just take it step by step. That means that if they wouldn't have made this enactment, what would the halacha have been? That I not only could be able to ransom them for as much as need be, but I would be obligated, as we already saw in the Rambam, eight different sources that would obligate me, or me in the terms of the community as a whole, to ransom whoever is being held hostage for, presumably for any amount that is being asked. That would be the din midoraisa, that if the terrorists say we want $50 billion, it would be the responsibility of the Jewish community to get together and raise $50 billion to help whoever we have to help. Only because of this special takana for social welfare, mipnei tikkun olam, the rabbanim made an enactment, no more than their actual value. Let's talk about how do you define a value of a person? Well, this itself could be a shiur of its own. There's basically two streams in the achronim of how we define the value of an individual when it comes to ransoming them. One stream is the simplest one, and you could probably figure it out online, with a few keystrokes on Google. How much does a slave cost in the slave market? You have to put in a variables: how intelligent he is, how tall he is, how strong he is, how much he could bench press, how old, you know, all the basic issues that you have to find out. And based on the skills, the age, we could figure out the value of a person in the slave market. Let's say a person in the slave market, and I guess now it's a little bit more difficult, but certainly a few hundred years ago they didn't have Google then. Either way, we could figure out some basic range of what's an appropriate value to set on a person's persona. Person X is worth $300,000 if you were to be sold in the slave market. So this Mishnah would be telling me that you are permitted to ransom him if he's held hostage for up to $300,000, because that's his value on the slave market. That's one stream of thought in the achronim of how to define the value of Yoser Mikdei Demehen. There's a different stream of thought. And that is that when I go about figuring out how to define the value, we look at hostage situations. In the international community, if somebody is held ransom, what would people pay in hostage negotiations? And that's a very different price. That's not talking about a slave market, that's talking about if we have to go to Mexico and find out that last time that the mafia took a hostage and they demanded a ransom, how much did people shell out of the pocket? Was it $3 million? Was it $5 million? Was it $7 million? What's the going rate for what people are willing? Or perhaps back in the Cold War where we had spy trades, Russia versus America, we'll give you one, we'll give you three spies, it goes one spy, we'll give you whatever the deals were. And somehow based on that, calculate, and this is going to be a very, very different number, but based on hostage negotiations, how we would to what extent people would go to redeem their hostages in a hostage situation. These are very two different streams of thought in the Achronim, and come out with two very different numbers of how high we could go in terms of having to shell out money to redeem such a hostage. Now, let's put that aside in terms of how to define the value. We said that whatever the value is, let's pick a number, let's pick $3 million. $3 million, the Chazal said, I'm not allowed to pay more than $3 million to redeem this, whoever the hostage we're discussing. Now, why not? We pay tikkun olam for social welfare. What's this tikkun olam? What is the social welfare involved? That's on the next source, the Gemara, on that Mishnah. Source number 4. actually offers two different explanations. The easier one to understand is actually the second one. I'm sorry, the first one. Mishum duchka de tzibura. Duchka de tzibura. We're familiar with the idea of duchka de tzibura. Sometimes on days after Rosh Chodesh or days after Chanukah, you come to shul and there's a laning day. And I'm late for work and the gabbai forgot to roll the Sefer Torah. So everyone's waiting there. Duchka de tzibura. Everyone's waiting and they have to wait 37 seconds until the gabbai rolls the Sefer Torah to where it's supposed to be. And that's a real, you know, a real travesty. 37 seconds, I'm going to miss my train that I always plan on making. Those 37 seconds are at the end of the world. That's one kind of tircha de tzibura. And here we're talking about a little bit of a bigger travesty. If, for example, they would say, okay, you have a fellow Jew, and we're going to hold him hostage for $50 billion. Let's say that number we mentioned before. And without any rabbinic enactment, without any tikkun olam, the halacha would be that not only could we, but we're obligated to shell out that $50 billion. What's going to happen to the Jewish population? What's going to happen to the Jewish community? We'll be wiped out without any modern, you know, without any of current events. We'll be wiped out from just very simply one of these hostage situations a year. We'll wipe out the whole community for the year's earnings. They'll do it again next. They'll wipe us out again. That's going to be an undue burden on the community. And that's dukkha de tzibura. So therefore, to avoid that dukkha de tzibura, to avoid that undue burden to the community, Chazal said you can't pay above the going rate for people. Either way, on the slave market or in hostage negotiation. That's the simpler understanding of why the Rabbanim put the cap on the price. The next two words of the Gemara are a little bit more complex. The next two words of the Gemara are Odilma Mishun Delo Ligruvu Velaisei Tvei. Or maybe the reason why we can't pay an unended amount, an uncapped amount, is because we don't want them to do it again. That's very, very logical. This is the policy, this is the svar, this is the logic behind the United States non-negotiation policy with terrorist groups. What happens if you capitulate to their demands once? All you're doing is one thing. You're doing nothing more than encouraging them to go ahead and do it one more time. And another time, and another time. If they say 50 billion, what are you telling them? And you pay up, what's going to happen? They'll do it tomorrow. The next time they're running low on cash, they'll do it again. Why? Because it works. It's worthwhile. Especially if they know that the Jews are the only ones who do this. Because after all, we have 8 mitzvot, asei and lotei say, that bind us to do this. So they're going to see that, hey, the Jews have to do it. They have to pay up. So we'll ask some crazy amounts. And as much as whatever we do, if we capitulate to their demands, then they'll be encouraged to do it again. That's the worst possible thing. That's true, as I know from this summer. After the Lebanon War began, and they saw how successful Hezbollah saw how successful they were by abducting soldiers, their new plan of action is not just to bomb or to missile or to attack, is to do whatever they can to try to abduct more soldiers, because they see what a heavy toll it is on the Jewish neshama for us to know that we have a Gilad Shalit, and how many prisoners of war they could get back for one Jewish neshama. So therefore, Chazal already instituted a non-negotiation policy with terrorists. We'll pay up to the regular value, and it's no more worthwhile for you, Mr. Terrorist, to kidnap a Jew than it is to kidnap any other person anywhere else in the world. We're no different. We're not going to pay a penny more than that set value. And that's going to be the Tikkun Olam. So those are two ways to understand why the Rabban has made the cap. Either made the cap not to put an undue burden on the community chest, or so that we don't encourage more hostage taking. Now, what's the nafka mina? What's the difference whether it's one reasoning or the other? Either way, they put a cap at, well, first, they put a cap at whatever the number will be. Let's say 3 mil. They put a cap at 3 mil. What's the difference whether the reason is because of the undue financial burden or because it's going to encourage terrorists to do it again? The nafka mina will be the difference between these two opinions would be, let's say you have a very wealthy person and he has a big checkbook. And he's willing to pay the amount. Let's say his son was the one who was captured. He's willing to pay the amount on his own from his own pocket. So if we say that we don't want to put an undue burden on the Jewish community, then is he allowed to ransom himself? Well, of course, you're not putting any burden at all on the Jewish community. He's going to pay for everything from his own pocket. So he would be able to ransom himself for any price. But on the other hand, if we say that if we capitulate to the terrorist demands one time, they'll be encouraged to do it again. So he says, oh, my son is captured. It's okay, I'll write out a check, whatever you want. 10 million, I have it, no problem. I'm sorry. The rabbi's going to knock on his door and say, sorry, you can't write the check. What do you mean? It's my own money. Let me do it with my own money when I please. Absolutely not. If you give in to the demands of the terrorists, you know what he's going to do? He'll take somebody else's son. And you don't have the right to be generous with your pocket on the future, at the expense of the future, God forbid, hostages of Klal Yisrael. And that's going to be the nafkamina. That's going to be the difference whether we take one approach or the other approach. If you're willing to pay out of your own pocket, if it's because of the undue burden on the community chest, it would be permitted to pay from your own pocket. If it's because of a concern that they'll do it again, so we won't allow you to do it even from your own pocket. That's the introduction to the sugya, and this is the basic building blocks that any shiloh that relates to this issue will deal with. Let's get into a more specified question. So that's number 6, we have a story. Now, of course, there are stories and there are stories. I guess today, this morning's stories are not the most cheerful. Well, this is a story that's recorded in the Gemara and Gittin that we're allowed to learn on Tisha B'Av. We know that on Tisha B'Av we're not allowed to learn too many things. One of the things is the Gemara's recording of Churban Bayis Sheni, when Rome came and took us to Golus. And in that story, in Nun Ches Amud Aleph, we have a story of Rabbi Yeshua wandering along in the streets of Rome, and in a dungeon cell, he hears, or he sees, a beautiful little Jewish boy, and he says, oh, he calls out, citing a pasuk, calls out some pasuk, oh, how was it that Hashem allowed this to happen to the Jewish people? And the little boy gives a perfect answer. A little kid, he's probably below Bar Mitzvah. He just gives a beautiful answer, quoting a pasuk in the right way, with the right understanding. And Yeshua says, I see that this kid is going to be a Gadol B'Yisrael. I see that this kid is going to be a Gadol B'Yisrael. The way he answered the question, the way he understood that it's all from Hashem, which is what he answered. How could it be that this happens to the Jewish people? And the boy said, it's all from Hashem, quoting a pasuk in the right way, understanding what's behind it. This kid is going to be a great person in Klal Yisrael. I'm not budging from here until I ransom him and I get him out of jail for whatever the price will be. That's the Gemara. What's the obvious question? He's not allowed to do that. In fact, he did. The Gemara says that Rabbi Yeshua did exactly that point, exactly that thing that he said he would do. He ransomed him for a huge amount of money. But wait a second. I thought we said, based on the whole thing we've been discussing, the Mishnah again that says you're not allowed to ransom a person for more than their value. And he did. He violated the halacha. So how are we going to put this story in the Gemara, which the Gemara sounds is like that's what he was supposed to do. Rabbi Yeshua is one of the great Tanaim. So how is he able to do that if it seems to be usher to ransom somebody for more than their value? That question is asked by Tosas in source number 7. Tosas asks, if you're not allowed to redeem somebody for more than their value, how come here of Yeshua redeemed this prison child, this prisoner child, for more than the kid's value? Tosas offers two answers. Tosas says, and I think both of these answers are important for, you know, not just halakhically, but to build our own Jewish Weltanschauung. Tosa says that this kid, he wasn't a Talmud Chacham, he was a little boy. But Yeshua saw that he was going to become a Talmud Chacham. And for a Talmud Chacham, we're ready to pay any amount that is asked of us. There's no way to put a price, to put a value, not on the slave market, not in hostage negotiations, however we want to figure out the numbers. To put the price on a Talmud Chacham, there's no way, says Tosa, that we could ever put a value, and therefore, for such a person, and as you see from this story, not even a person who's actually a Talmud Chacham, but somebody who has the potential to become a Talmud Chacham, we can never put a price on such a person, and therefore there is no price. And whatever is asked for them, we have to redeem. That's the first answer of Tosa's. The second answer is more of a political answer. Tosa says that Sha'as HaChurban, time of destruction, which is when the story took place, when actually Josephus writes, historically, there's not a halachic source, there's a historical source, Josephus writes that at the time of the Churban Bayis Sheni, there were 97,000 prisoners of war. 97,000 shevuyim that were taken captive by the Romans when they came to do Churban Bayis Sheni. So, says Tosis, I mean, he doesn't mention the number, he just sees his number, but says to us, Sha'at HaChurban is shiny. The time of Churban Bayis Sheni is different. I'm just explaining to you why. Why is it different? Because So we're not talking about one here, one there, all they'll do it again. They're taking everybody hostage. Anybody they could get their hands on, they're taking hostage. They're shipping them off to the slave markets of Rome. One here, one there. It's not a question of negotiating here, or it's going to do an undue. Anyway, the burden is unbearable. We don't have any money anyway. We've been exiled. Anyway, we're not worried about they'll do it again. They are doing it again, regardless of whether we ransom them or not. So Sha'asu Chulman is different. That's why Rabbi Yeshua is allowed to redeem him for any amount, because there were unique circumstances of that specific historical time. Some people here might be wondering something. Tosis' first answer was that for a Talmud Chacham we should give any amount of money. The most celebrated case historically of a Jewish prisoner, a Jewish hostage, where we applied these rules of non-negotiation policy was Mahram Mirotenberg. 800 years ago or so, Mahram Mirotenberg was the Rebbe of the Rush. About 800 years or so, give or take, 100. The Mahram Mirotenberg was taken captive by Emperor Rudolf I. I did a little bit of research. Yes, Emperor Rudolf I. I think in Germany, Austria, Prussia, the lines change every few years. Emperor Rudolf I takes the Mahram Mirotenberg, the Gadol Hadar, the undisputed Gadol Hadar in Ashkenaz, captive. And of course said, okay, you want your Gadol Hadar back? No problem. Write out a check. For obviously a huge, huge, huge sum of money. And you know what? The Jewish people got the money together and they were ready to pay, and Mahram Mirotenberg sent a psak from his dungeon cell in the Tower of Aigzam, the Aigzam Tower, that no, you are not permitted to redeem me, according to the Mishnah in Gittin that we learned at the very beginning of the Shir, that Ein Poldin es Ashrun Yosem Mikadei Demehan Mipnei Tikkun Olam. But wait a second. Didn't Tosis just tell us that for a Talmud Chacham, and we're not talking about just a regular Talmud Chacham, we're talking about the Gadol Hadar, the undisputed Gadol Hadar of Ashkenaz, that you're not allowed to redeem that for more than their value. That you are redeemed. Tosis says that for a Talmud Chacham, you are permitted to redeem that for more than their value, because they have infinite value. So how come Mahram Mirotenberg, and I assure you, Mahram Mirotenberg knew that. So how come he said, you're not allowed to redeem me? This question, it's a historical question, but it was asked by the Yamshel Shlomo, the Marashal, in source number 8. How could it be that Mahram Mirotenberg didn't allow himself to be redeemed? After all, he was a Talmud Chacham. So maybe you'll say, yeah, he was humble. He didn't really think he was worthy to be, that Talmud Chacham, that's a priceless Talmud Chacham. Okay, here we could argue a little bit. First of all, he wasn't stupid. He might have been humble, he wasn't stupid. A Gadol knows that he's a Gadol because he gets the hardest questions that no one else has the answers to. They come to him. So he's the one who's getting the questions, and he's the one who all the other rabbis are sending their shaylos, so he knows who he is. So maybe he just felt that, even so, Merov an v'sanusa, from the great humility that he had, as great as I am, or even I am the greatest in the generation and the greatest person in Ashkenaz, maybe that's still not the level of Talmud Chacham that was discussed, that's worthy of being said. I'm still not on the level of Talmud Chacham, maybe in the time of the Churban Bayis Sheni, like that story of the prisoner child. Well, says Marshal, even if he had a humility, but that still doesn't really answer why he didn't allow himself to be redeemed. What about the learning Torah that he was involved with? What about the psak that Klai Yisrael needed from him? Forget it. We're going to put him on the side. Maybe he himself doesn't deserve whatever reason. Klai Yisrael needed his psak. This is the person, the last stop on the train for all halachic shaylos and Ashkenaz, the top of the totem pole. Klai Yisrael needs his psak. How does he have the right? Fine, he wants to be humble on his account. Great. But how could he be humble on the account of Klai Yisrael? And the Marshal quotes a beautiful letter that the Maram wrote from the dungeon cell. An Yoshev b'choshech b'li ora b'li Torah. I'm sitting in the darkness without Torah. Ein li sifrei harishon, ein li sifrei hatosos v'aposkim. I don't have my svarim here. I can't deal with I can't do my learning properly. I'm sitting here in a dungeon. Obviously, a few letters did get out, but at the same time, he wasn't as accessible in Aigzam Tower as he otherwise would be to the community. So Marshal answers that there must be the following thought process going through the Mahram Rotenberg's mind. If you think about it, this thought process makes a lot of sense. What are we worried about? We're worried about that it's not fair for Torah, that Klai Yisrael needs his Torah. Well, the Mahram Rotenberg said, you're worried about Torah? Okay, let's just figure out the two possibilities. If I say, okay, ransom me for whatever, $10 billion, whatever the Emperor Rudolf was demanding, So what did Rebbe Rudel find out? That Jews will pay anything for the Godel Hador. So what do you think is going to happen every single generation from here for all of history, from now on? Every time there's a Godel Hador, the emperor, whoever it might be at that time, or Tsar, whoever might be at that time, is going to do what? Take the Godel Hador and lock him up in prison and say, okay, pay us some unbearable amount and we'll, for whatever, we'll try to make it happen. So what's going to happen? First, you're going to wipe out the Jewish community as well for all of history, and the Jewish community is not going to have any Godel Hador because they're all going to be locked up in jail throughout every stage in history. I'm going to do it again and again and again. So you worried about the loss of the Talmud Torah of the people in the time of Maharam Rothenberg? If I let myself be redeemed, says Maharam, then you're going to lose so much Torah for all of history. I'd rather that Klal Yisrael lose the little bit of Torah that I could offer them, even though I could offer more than anyone else in my time. I'd rather lose that little bit of Torah in this tiny slice of history so that future generations will be able to have Torah. In other words, Maharam Rothenberg said, let me be the korban, and let me be the korban and the loss of Torah to this generation, so future generations could have Torah. And you know what? He was right. Historically, we don't know of any other situations where the Goyim took the Godel Hador. There were similar stories, but he was right. In fact, do you know who was next online after Maharam Rothenberg? I said, whose Rebbe was he? He was the Rush's Rebbe. There's a time in history that the Rush had to change from Ashkenaz to Sfard. Do you know when? Right at that time. The Rush knew that his Rebbe was taken and he's next online. If he's next online, that means he's next to be taken hostage by Emperor Rudolf. At that point in time, historically exactly, is when he fled Ashkenaz, he moved to Sfard, and that's when the Rush changed, you know, instead of being the leader, the new leader of Ashkenaz, he moved to Spain, to the Spanish community, wherever it was, either Spain or North America, Tulia, the Marshal says, I'm not sure what, Toledo, I guess they'd call it. And that's the time in history when the Rush moves, he had to flee because he was next online after Maharam. He was Maharam's Star Talmud. And you know what? He didn't get captured. And the rest of history with the Maharam's cheshbon, the Maharam's thought processes proved himself to be correct. Sorry?
Tosis apparently didn't have
that. Okay, we'll leave that afterwards. That's a question. The question was, how could, if for Talmud Chacham you could ransom anything, how come Maharam didn't allow himself? And this answer. Fine. Now let's go to the next step. In source number 9, we have a Mishnah that seems a little bit awkward based on the whole discussion that we've been having until now. The Mishnah talks about what happens if a person's wife is taken hostage. So, and they demand 10 times her value. Again, however you define her value, based on the slave market or based on present hostage negotiations, they demand 10 times her value. Of course, if your wife asks, would learn this mission, say, sweetheart, how much would you pay for me? I say, regardless of whatever I say here and whatever the halakha says, you say, sweetheart, whatever it takes. Okay, but now we'll put that aside. Shalom bayis Trump's all, right. Trump's all. Everything. Okay. With that, having said that, putting that aside, now let's get to the halacha. Okay, so what can we do if a person's wife is taken hostage? They demand 10 times her value. We have a machlokas here, machlokas, tanakam, and Rav Shimon Gamliel. If I'm allowed to redeem my wife for 10 times her value, or I'm not allowed. Okay, that's machlokas that we have. The simplest question arises. Haven't we been discussing for half an hour that you're not allowed to pay more than a person's value to redeem them? So why should your wife be any different than anybody else? Of course, your wife has an answer for that. But nevertheless, why are you allowed to pay for your wife more than anyone else? Sorry? Okay, you're doing it on your own. That solves one problem. There's Toka Gufo. Right? Right? That's all correct. Well, the answer sort of is, and we'll talk about this, let's say I'm taken captive. Can I redeem myself? So there's a Tosus that I never mentioned. Tosus says, he actually brings a pasuk from Eov. Fascinating source. What's the story of Eov? Eov is a game, a contest between the Satan and God himself. And the Sefer Eov begins the first 2-3 parakim of Eov with the following discussion. Hashem says to the Satan, hey Satan, did you see my great boy Eov? Eov is such a tzaddik. And Satan says, oh, really? Hashem says, yeah, really. So Satan says, yeah, I know why he's a tzad. He's a tzad because everything's going great. So Hashem says, no. He'd be a tzad under all circumstances. Satan says, oh, yeah, really? Hashem says, yeah, really. And Hashem says, I'm telling you. Satan says, oh, really? Yeah, sure. Okay, let me do a job on him. And we'll see if he'll still be such a great tzad. She says, no problem. Do whatever you want. Just don't touch him. Do whatever you want to all of his wealth, all of his family. And just don't touch him. And we'll see if he'll be a tzaddik. Satan says, okay, deal. He goes out, and he basically, in, like we know from previous months and how wealth could come very worthless very quickly, wipes out all of his wealth, and all of his camels just pop dead, and all of his children they're all at a party, and the roof falls in, they're all dying instantly, and he gets one message, your kids all died, and gets another message, your wealth is all your wealth has disappeared, and in a split second, he becomes absolutely poverty-stricken and childless. Instantly. And you know what? As the pasuk says, Eov lo chata. And Eov still didn't blaspheme Hashem. He still was a tzaddik. So of course, the next rendezvous between Hashem and the Satan, Hashem says, you see, I did it, I was right. And Satan says, so far, you're right. And Hashem says, well, what do you mean so far? Satan says, yeah, because you didn't let me touch him. So Hashem says, okay, you're saying you'll only believe me that he's not going to be chote and he won't blaspheme me if he doesn't have any pain? Hashem says, yeah. Or ba'ad or. Kol Hashem lo yitain ba'ad nashav. Skin for the skin. A person will give anything to save his own flesh, says the Satan. Hashem says, oh, yeah, I guess. Okay, fine. So now you could cause him some physical pain. And then Satan says, yeah, when I cause him physical pain, you'll see, oh, my goodness, he's going to start cursing you. You'll see. That's what the Satan says. So Hashem says, okay, fine. You could cause him pain. You could give him sicknesses. But keep him alive. Satan says, okay, deal. He goes back to work. Satan goes back to work, and all of a sudden, Eov has these boils and this terrible pain and all this physical uncomfort. But what was that one line that I mentioned, that pasuk? Or ba'ad or v'kol asher lo yitain ba'ad nafsho. Skin for the skin, and anything a person has, he will pay for his own flesh. This pasuk from Sefer Eov is cited by Tosos as telling us, as being a source, that to redeem yourself, you're allowed to give any amount. All the svaros, all the logical reasons for this or for that, for the community concern and for the future, what's going to happen in future hostages. However, if it's your money, you are allowed, if a person himself is taken hostage, God forbid, and he is ransomed for any amount, this Paskin Eov instructs us that a person is allowed to pay any amount of money to save his own skin. That's how Tosis Paskins. So for yourself, you could spend any amount of money. As the Satan told, it's funny, we're learning halachas from the Satan. Fascinating. Okay. Fascinating. And it makes its way into the Shulchan Aruch, in fact. Yes, we learn. So was the Satan good? Yes, for some things. So to redeem yourself for any amount of money, that we learn from this pasuk, this is an exception. Yourself, you are allowed to redeem because of the Satan's discussion that we learn from pasuk that you're allowed to spend anything to redeem yourself. And of course, we have the halachic rule that some people mentioned earlier, ish toke kegufo, a wife is just like myself. So therefore, if I'm allowed to spend billions out of my own for myself, if I'm held hostage, so too I'm allowed to spend the same billions for my wife. That would be the rationale for the opinion that says that you are permitted to redeem your wife for more than her value. But if we think about this, again, we see here that this Mishnah says, it records a machlokas, whether one's permitted to spend 10 times their wife's value or not. We see that, if we think a little bit, you know what's going to come out? You know what it sounds like? Again, one opinion says that for your wife, you could spend anything. Why is that? Because you're allowed to spend anything for yourself. And each took a goof for you, so you could spend anything just like for yourself, for your wife as well. The other opinion says, no, can't spend more than her value. Obviously, he doesn't apply each took a goof to that extent. But if you think about these two opinions, it sounds, with a little bit of thought, that these two opinions are actually arguing about what point? They're arguing about what the reason, what the rationale for that takanas chachamim, for that rabbinic enactment of not allowing Yoser Alden and Mayhem. If we say that the whole reason why you're not allowed to redeem somebody for more than their value is because duka ditzibura, because of the community burden, well, if it's for your own wife, from your own pocket, what should be the halacha? You should be able to redeem her for as much as you want, because it's not burdening the community. It's burning your own checkbook, and you can handle it. You're willing to handle it. You'd rather handle it than suffer her wrath from that phone call from prison. Sweetheart, I know you're redeeming me for $10 billion. You'd rather just write out the check for $10 billion than have to have that phone call. But if we would say that we're worried about future, what that they're going to be encouraged to take hostage in the future, then the fact that she's your wife shouldn't give us a dispensation for redeeming her more than her value. Just because she's your wife, she's going to give you an earful on the phone. That means that you're allowed to put future Jews in jeopardy? Absolutely not. So it sounds at first glance that these two opinions that are arguing here in this new Mishnah about ransoming a wife for more than her value probably sounds like perhaps the Rashba suggests are arguing about the point. What is the reasoning? If the reasoning that we're not allowed to redeem something for more than the value is because of the burden to the community, well, here you're not burdening the community. And you should be permitted to redeem her for more than her value. But if the reasoning that you're not permitted to redeem somebody for more than the value is because of future generations, future hostages, well, here we should be equally concerned, even if it's your wife at stake. We have to be equally concerned with future hostages, and we should not be permitted to redeem her. So we have to find out.
Assume that some other husband will give for his wife. How can they deduce that?
If it works, it works. If it works one time,
one case,
so they'll do it, sir.
A wife will wealth find the second man, but not
100%. So they'll do it. We have to be worried. Again, these are the two sides. We have to be worried. On one hand, it might not be a concern to the community. Those are the two sides. It's a valid question. It's a valid question. Until now, we mentioned one reason why a wife would be different. Because since you could redeem yourself, and that's clear, so too you could redeem your wife because ishto kegufo. I want to tell you another reason why maybe your wife might be different, why maybe you could redeem your wife for more than her value. Imagine the following brilliant scenario. Let's say in Mexico today, we know that the very wealthy people have to have bodyguards. Why do they need bodyguards? They have bodyguards at the door of their estates. They have bodyguards when they travel. Why? Because they'll be kidnapped and ransomed, exactly. And if even the police are corrupt in Mexico, I don't want to cast aspersions on anybody, but it's known that the police themselves are often on the side of the mafia who do the kidnappings, and they're going to get a cut from the ransom. And this is Ma'isim B'chol Yom, Hashem Yishmar. Both the Jewish wealthy people and the not-Jewish wealthy people equally are in danger of being kidnapped for a very quick, a mafia person wants to make a quick $7 million. So I have a great idea. We know that AIG got a bailout from the federal government, so we're going to create a new insurance policy. And we're going to make a lot of money on this. We're going to offer ransom payment policies. And we'll cater this. We'll talk to, Smith Barney, and we'll talk to Goldman Sachs, and they should all their Mexican clients who are valued at $50 million or more will approach them, and we'll tell them we will offer you the following insurance policy. If you pay, say $10,000 a month, on a regular schedule, $10,000 a month, $120,000 a year after year, as long as you want to maintain this policy, we will guarantee that if you are ransomed, if you are taken hostage, we, the insurance policy, will pay your ransom. Not a bad idea. Because, hey, if you figure out the numbers, how much am I paying for my bodyguard? Paying him $50,000 a year, and I have two bodyguards, $100,000 a year, for an extra $20,000, I don't have to worry about losing. That's a great idea for an insurance policy. Okay, so what happens? Lo and behold, the mafia swoops down on this wealthy person as he's pulling out his Rolls Royce from his $12 billion estate, and they capture him, they take him hostage, and they say, okay, we want $10 million by Tuesday morning. So from his cell phone in his little dungeon in some cellar in Mexico City. He calls up the insurance policy. Hi, I can't speak Spanish, so I'm not going to do such a great job. Hi, taken hostage. I need $10 million as per your policy that I've been, paying on schedule the past 2.5 years. I need $10 million delivered to whatever address by Tuesday morning at 9 a.m. 1 second, please. It puts them on hold. And a few minutes later, manager comes on the line and says, please, can I help you? And you go through the story again. I need $10 million delivered to this address in some basement in Mexico City by Tuesday morning at 9 a.m. He says, aha, sure, I hear what you're saying. I definitely understand that you do have a policy with us. But I'm very sorry. There's actually a Mishnah in Gittin that says, "Ein poldin es hashvili nyosav kadeg demehen." And of course, we're talking about a Jewish. Who else would come up with such a plan with such an insurance plan? So we love to pay. We understand. We feel very bad. We'll even refund your premiums. Of course, we've never be bad on that. Please, we'll write you out a check. Where would you like it delivered? But we halacha binds us whether it's an undue burden to, even forget about the undue burden to the community. We're still worried about future hostages. We would never want this to become rampant. We would never want the mafia to take advantage of this. And I'm sorry, but your claim is denied. Would that make sense? Is that a valid claim? So let me just formulate it in a different way. We know that for myself, I could redeem myself as much as I'm worth. Here, I bought the right for myself to be redeemed. It might not be my money that's paying for it. It's the insurance policy. It's the insurance company that's paying for it. But I bought from them that right to be redeemed if I ever get captured. So who's having bought that right by paying my premiums? Who really is the one who is ultimately paying for this? It's really me paying for my own right to be redeemed. And we know that we say, Orbad, Orba Khalasha, Lo Yitin Ba'anafsho, that pasuk that we learned from the Satan, that I'm allowed to pay as much money as I need to redeem myself. So I can either do it from my checkbook, or having paid the policies, this is something that I am owed, and therefore I rightfully own the right through whatever, I don't want to mention any insurance company, I don't know who works in MetLife here or anything, but through MetLife, I really now own the right to be redeemed. And they shouldn't have any, because they shouldn't say, oh, we're not allowed to do it, halach, mishum gin, dafan, and whatever, amr aleph. After all, no, for myself I could redeem myself, so you're just like an extension of myself, because I bought the right, I bought it to myself, I bought myself the right to be redeemed, should this ever happen. Now, says the Rush, based on this logic, and this little explanation I heard from Yonah Metzger, the Rav Rashi, the Ashkenazi Rav Rashi of Eretz Yisrael, at that convention, we also talked about a similar topic, to explain the following Rush. The Rush says that when a woman gets married, she gets a ksuva. And one of the things that it says in the ksuva is that she'll be redeemed. Her husband will redeem her. Doesn't say for how much, doesn't say if it's excessive, just says her husband will redeem her. But what's the idea of a ksuva? Idea of a ksuva is no less than an insurance policy. Insurance policy is, you give me this, I'll give you that, you pay the premiums, we'll provide this coverage. She gets married to you, and the husband's for all of his, for the past 2,500 years, had to provide certain guarantees to the safety, to her safety, and whatever, some parts of Doraisa, parts of Derabanan, she got herself an insurance policy that states that should something happen to her, the husband has to heal her, has to pay for medical bills, husband has to pay for a burial cost, the husband has to pay for redemption, to redeem her. Now, could the husband say, I don't want to pay more than her going rate? I don't want to pay more than the whatever the number, the cap that Chachamim instituted? Could the husband say that? Well, before we said, no, he can't, because Ishto Kagufo, so you're allowed to pay just like for yourself. Now we're saying something much more sophisticated. We're saying that through her ksuva, that is owned by her, those are rights that are owned by her, she has acquired herself the right to be redeemed as though it's her money. As though she's the one who's redeemed herself. We said that you're allowed to redeem yourself for any value. So now we're saying that through the ksuva, she has acquired for herself an insurance policy which gives her her own right for self-redemption. Okay, it happens to be the one who's writing out the check is the husband. Just like the insurance holder The insurance company, MetLife, is the one who's writing out the check to the mafia. So to hear the husband is writing out the check to the mafia. But the point being is that it's her right that she bought by getting married to him, whatever the deal of upon marriage was. Now listen to this bit of lumdus that I'm about to say, how we apply it to shilas that are on the cusp of our minds and what we deal with right now. The following lumdus was offered by Rav Shaul Yisraeli in the previous Rosh Hashivas of Merkaz Harav. You could take it, you could leave it, you might agree, you might disagree, but it will certainly get some of your minds brewing. If you have a soldier, 2008, 2006, who takes 2-3 years of the prime years of his life, doesn't go to college, doesn't go straight to work, doesn't sit and learn yeshiva full-time like he might want to, and he gives it to the government. He gives it to the Jewish people. And then, God forbid, on the northern front, on the edge of Lebanon, he's abducted. He's taken captive. Is this similar to a woman who has earned her right to be redeemed, and therefore it's like her redeeming herself because it's owed to her? Or is this similar to a guy who's paying premiums? Is it easier to pay premiums in cash, or is it easier to pay premiums by giving 3 years of your life to somebody? Maybe one could argue, suggests Rav Shaul Yisraeli, that just like an insurance policy where I pay a regular sum entitles me to the rights, and I can demand that they're my right. Is my right to be redeemed? It says, no, I'm redeemed myself because I made a kinyan on that right of redemption. And a woman in the same way has a different kind of insurance policy. When she entered this ksuva contract, she gave her thing, she gives to the husband, and her husband has to assume his own responsibilities. That what? That she acquired, at the moment of marriage, she acquired the right to in the future be redeemed by her husband. One could suggest, and you have to realize that we're treading on very, very, very delicate waters, because these are the kinds of svaras that are potentially being used to deal with the shadows of Gilad Shalit and Regev, that were being dealt with this summer. These are the kind of svaras that were being redeemed, and that were being dealt with, and this is frightening stuff. Could a soldier claim in some Hezbollah dungeon that I paid my insurance premium for the past 2 years, I wanted to be in studying computer science at Hebrew University. I wanted to be sitting and learning Bava Kamma in Yeshiva XYZ, and I paid my premium. I gave my 2-3 years to the Israeli people. I have thereby acquired the right to be redeemed, just like at any cost, just like the wife has acquired her right to be redeemed when she got married because of the ksuva. And just like the insurance holder has acquired his right to be redeemed from the insurance provider in Mexico. And based on this logic, Rav Shaul Yisraeli suggests maybe it would be appropriate to say that if the soldier has acquired the right to redeem himself, then we would be able to redeem a soldier who's abducted for any value, without any cap, priceless. No number, no maximum. Which is very frightening. I assume what you're going to ask is that still might lead to future abductions. We'll get to that as we close. Yes. The deal, the issues at hand are not just a question of finances, which are a lot easier to talk about money. Because money, you could be a billionaire and lose every penny and you feel fine, your body is healthy, you're no in any worse more precarious situation, and you'll probably have lunch tomorrow anyway. Yes, money is very easy to let go of, as opposed to other things which are much more difficult, and we'll talk about those in the last minute of this year. Just hold on a few minutes, so if that's okay, just so we can finish up. I want to conclude with one caveat. That's an important caveat to take into consideration that I maybe unfairly kept you in the dark of. Maybe it wasn't fair. There are two kinds of hostages. And halacha might see a difference between them, and that's what we'll discuss in the next 6-7 minutes. There's a hostage that they want money. And if not, then I don't know what. There's another hostage that they want money, and if not, they're going to kill. They want to kill somebody. We could bribe them. We could buy the guy back. But they really want to kill him. Or there's a hostage, they just want money. The truth be told, in Mexico, they have no interest in killing. The mafia has no interest in killing. They couldn't care less. They don't know if they never saw the guy. They have nothing against the guy. All they know is that he drives a Rolls Royce, and he has a beautiful 7-acre estate in downtown Mexico City. So they know he's worth a lot, and they want his money. He's a beautiful guy, wonderful guy. He'd give them stuck if he saw them on the street, but they just want his money. And that's a very different story than Hezbollah, who are less worried about the money, they more just want to kill. Is there a difference between ransoming somebody if he's being held just for money, as opposed to if he's being held for with sakanas nefashos? So here we have to shift for a minute to talk about a different kind of scenario in the Gemara. The case we're going to talk about is not a guy who was taken hostage, who was abducted, but rather a person who's mocher atzmo. He's low on cash, and he figures, I can't pay my bills, and I can't pay my kids' tuition, and so I have a great idea, I'm just going to sell myself. And not only that, I'll sell myself and my family. And to some generous person who needs some help in his factory and doesn't want to pay, salaried worker, he'd rather have a slave. So I'll sell myself and my family to this slave buyer for his plantation. So he's working as a slave, and he has to work a lot. He has to pick a lot of cotton. He doesn't like picking cotton, so he writes a letter to the UJA. It says, "Dear UJA, I sold myself as a slave on this plantation, and I don't like picking cotton. Please save me. Please redeem me." And by the way, P.S. There, if you look at the Rambam, Hilchos Matanos Aniyim Perches Lachayug, you will notice that there are 8 mitzvahs, asay and lotasay, that obligate you, UJA, to redeem me. Do they have to redeem him? Well, here the Mishnah says flat out, and this is source number 14. The Mishnah says flat out, you better not redeem him. You better not redeem him. Somebody who wasn't taken hostage, he wasn't abducted. He sold himself to be a hostage? To put himself into slavery? You don't redeem such a person. You know why? He'll do it again. He'll do it again. However, there's a very fascinating twist. After he dies, and his sons are there on this plantation, you do have to redeem the children for any amount. Why? Kula says the Gemara, Choshin l'kil kula, where are they going to go off the derech? As long as their father was alive, their father taught them, made sure they put on tefillin in the morning, made sure they woke up for shacharis in the morning, made sure they took a break in the middle of the cotton picking plantation to daven mincha in the middle of the day. Once their father's dead, who's going to teach them? They're living in a goyish house. Everything's goyish there. So then who's going to teach them? So for that kilka, he's going to just lose his religiosity. You save the children. Next case. A guy, again, sells himself to, guess who? The Luda'i. Who are the Luda'i? This is source 15 and 16. 15. Luda'i are a people who happen to be
cannibals.
Bad luck. Of all the people you sold yourself to, it had to be the Luda'i. It could have been some nice plantation in the south, and it had to be somebody who's interested in you for lunch. Now, he writes, "Dear UJA, I would love to be a slave on a cotton picking plantation in the south. Unfortunately, I am supposed to be tomorrow's appetizer. Please redeem me. P.S. Of course, the Rambam Hilchos Matanos Aniyim Perches Halach Yud writes there are 8 mitzvahs of saying lotasei say that require you to redeem him. So what do? Do they redeem him? He sold himself. He put himself in his own situation. He brought it on himself. He wasn't abducted. He wasn't kidnapped. He put it on himself. He sold himself. He wanted the money. He sold himself. Do we redeem him? The Gemara says in Source 16 says a kal v'chomer. The Gemara says if in a case where we're worried about the religiosity of the children, that they're going to go off to death, they're not going to put on tefillin tomorrow morning after the father dies, they're not going to be so religious, we're willing to redeem somebody even though we shouldn't. So kal v'chomer, if a guy is going to be eaten for lunch, he's definitely not putting on tefillin for supper. If for redeem somebody so that the kids will stay religious, we can redeem somebody. Kal v'chomer, says the Gemara, to make sure a guy stays alive, we can redeem them for whatever value. That's the Gemara. Based on this Gemara, Tosos wants to suggest that maybe in scenarios where somebody's at risk of death, is being taken hostage and he's going to be killed, maybe there you could redeem somebody for more than their value. And this whole discussion that we had until now is out the window if we apply it to the Hezbollah. Because maybe if somebody's at the risk of death and he's abducted to be killed, then different rules apply. However, there's one very huge difference between these two cases. Who says that just because, if you sell yourself, so you did something wrong, it was terrible, but did the guy do anything wrong? Absolutely not. I mean, I'm not saying cannibals are good people, but they didn't go out and they buy their lunch. Like any self, you know, any person with a good, you know, they have a job and they work for a living. They you know, they're accountants during the day. They go to the store for dinner before dinner and they buy their dinner. They just make, you know what, okay. I don't know. They make sure to take off his glasses before they put him in the frying pan. If we redeem this person, are the goyim now going to abduct somebody else? They didn't abduct anybody in the first place. If we redeem this person who's about to be in for lunch, are the guy going to take advantage another time? More Jews are going to be captured. They're not capturing anybody. They're not doing anything wrong. They're just being law-abiding citizens who happen to buy their lunch and they eat funny food. That's all. How could we learn from there, from where a person happens to sell himself that they're going that he's allowed to be redeemed? How can we apply that so too, if a person is captured by the guy and by Hezbollah, and we capitulate to their demands that they'll also, that we could also pay any amount? What do you mean? All you're doing is encouraging them to do it again and do it again. So maybe you can't bring a raya, you can't bring any proof at all for the fact that you could redeem somebody who sold himself to cannibals for a lot of money. That so too, when a person is taken hostage by others, that also you can pay any amount of money. They're very different. In the case of somebody who's abducted, someone who's taken hostage by the Goyim in a terrorist attack, there maybe we're worried that the Goyim will do it again. So you can't. So we have to be worried that we don't want to encourage this policy, so we're going to have a non-negotiation tactic with terrorists, and we're not going to give in. I just want to conclude with two, and this is something to think about, two different positions on how this would apply in modern state, modern day Israel with modern day Shilas. And these are great conversation starters because each side is very, very, very powerful. At this convention that I was at this summer, I mentioned that Rav Yonah Metzger, the Ashkenazic Rav Rashi of Israel, spoke. He pointed out a statistic that 30-40% of prisoners, of Arab prisoners that are returned in hostage exchange, go back to terrorist activity. That means if the Israeli government were to return 1,000 hostages, 1,000 prisoners, Arab prisoners, back to the Hezbollah or whatever, 300-400 of them will resume terrorist activity. A. B. There are recorded, at least as of this summer, with the number that he mentioned, 185 Jewish deaths that were perpetrated by the very Arabs who were returned in prisoner swaps. So let's say, okay, trade, get back so-and-so for any price. Give back as many as we want. We need our boys. We need our boys back. These are the numbers. Okay, you could have we'll get our boy back, and we'll have to give back who knows how many. And what's going to happen to another 185 Jewish lives? Chas v'shalom, we have Hashem Yishmar. On the other hand, we have an army. Right now, the army knows that the government will do anything that they can to get them back alive or dead. And they know that. And they know that we're different than every other army in the world. And Mika Amcha Yisrael, we're going to do, the Jewish people are going to do whatever we need to do to get our boys back. For at least so the parents have a place to say Kaddish and where and know when to say Kaddish. For at least that. You know what that does? That boosts the morale of your army. You have a whole army to work. Forget 185, you can't forget about 185 Karbanos. But on the other hand, you have an army that has to be successful in battle. And we're dealing with very difficult times. We have to have the army at their highest morale. if they know that we are behind them 100%, then chances are they'll be ready to go on missions. They'll be ready to do things. They'll be ready to go on dangerous missions more easily because they know we're going to take care of them. And they're not going to be left in the dust. These are two very, very strong arguments. But I'm very glad I don't have to be the ones making these decisions. But at the same time, decisions like this are made and do have to be made. And Be'ezus Hashem, HaKadosh Baruch Hu will see to it that these decisions will not have to be made. That this shiur should hopefully be completely, completely, completely theoretical. No different than Ir Nidachas, Shelo Hayav Lo Nivra, Lo Nitzan Elo Litev Schar, Lo Skeyem. No different than Ben Soro Moro, which is never going to happen, can't happen, is never going to happen. It's just that we could learn and learn up the Sugya and get Schar. Be'ez Hashem, the Schar that we have for learning the Sugya this morning should bring us that to that stage that we shouldn't know from any of these things, and Hashem should protect Klal Yisrael.
Two questions.
Thank you very much for your early in. We'll start again in a few minutes with our